Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here. Hey.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talk House Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talk House Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. This week's episode is actually taken from a conversation that served as the online launch party for the second issue of our print zine, The Talk House Reader, which was lovingly put together by Talk House music editor Annie Fell. The issue, which you can order at store.talkhouse.com, explores the intersection of food and music, so naturally this episode does as well. Our guests are Jason Stewart and Rostam. Now, Jason Stewart, along with Chris Black, is the host of the popular podcast How Long Gone, in which the two discuss pop culture, fashion, and whatever else happens to come to mind, often with great guests. Recent ones include Jenny Lewis, Waxahachie, and Isaac Brock. But frequently, just the two of them gab like better read versions of your hippest friends. They're part of the fabulous Talkhouse Podcast Network, and you can catch the How Long Gone guys live this June if you're lucky enough to live in one of the cities they'll be visiting on tour. The tour dates and their deep catalog of episodes can be found at howlonggone.com. Today's other guest is Rostam, who's best known as a co-founder of Vampire Weekend and co-architect of that band's sound. Rostam left Vampire Weekend a few years ago to pursue solo and production work, and he's kept plenty busy. He made a great record with Hamilton Lighthouser of The Walkmen, as well as a fully solo record called Change Phobia. You may have heard him on the Talkhouse podcast talking about it with Michelle Zauner of Japanese Breakfast. He's released a few standalone songs recently as well, and as always, he's a thoughtful conversationalist with something interesting to say. Since this chat is focused largely on food, you can expect to hear about Rostam's egg habits, a killer salmon recipe, and some talk about Rostam's mom, who's a well-known chef of Persian food who once went toe-to-toe with Martha Stewart. Enjoy, and please check out the Talkhouse Reader issue 2 at store.talkhouse.com.
You're coming from your home, Rostam?
Yes.
Okay. In Los Angeles.
Somewhere in Los Angeles.
I know you don't like to dox yourself. I'm not trying, but we can say California.
Somewhere in Southern California.
Okay. How much have you thought about the placement of the camera in your home, the lighting, the angle, your outfit, those types of things, or is this just willy-nilly?
You know, it's interesting. I've done a bunch of Zooms in my studio, and I felt like today I wanted to take it out of the studio and give it a more casual kitchen feel because we've been tasked with talking about food, although I don't think we need to stay too on topic.
No, we never do. We never do. So, no. So a lot of times when you do these types of things, it's more music related. So you're in the studio with your musical equipment, and now you're in your space where you share meals with your home. Even though you're backlit, you look great. Just something to consider moving forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But let's talk a little bit about food. What have you eaten today so far? It's 2 p.m. California time. What has gone inside of that little body of yours so far today?
Well, I took 8 months off of caffeine. And then about 8 months ago, I got back on the coffee train.
Okay.
And
eight on, eight off. Got it.
We can talk about my evolution with coffee.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually like an artist that I was working with, Harrison, aka The Dare. He was drinking a vanilla iced latte, which I never had one of those in my life.
Like from Starbucks?
No, not from Starbucks, okay. From Alfred.
Artisan. Alfred, okay.
So I was 8 months caffeine sober, and I tasted his iced vanilla latte, and it fucked with me because I was like, oh, I remember coffee. I love the taste.
Yeah, and I was like, okay. That's a fucked up way to get that coffee inside of you. An Alfred vanilla latte, you know, that's just going to be a sugar bomb, like high school girls level of coffee. It's not like me, my cup of hot black coffee straight up, you know, the real shit. But
okay, so let's talk about the evolution. So then
let's do it.
So then I decided that I could have two espresso shots in the morning. And so a lot, you know, as you know, a latte has two espresso shots. In the last few months, I've migrated away from the vanilla iced latte, and I've migrated to an iced Americano, which has no sugar.
Good.
And no milk.
Yeah.
And
no pleasure.
I guess that's one way to look at it. And
I only order an Americano in an emergency.
Oh, really? What's the emergency for you?
They don't have regular drip coffee, and I'm traveling abroad, so you kind of have to get... That's the closest, you know, it's like a jailhouse coffee kind of thing. I'm fine with it. There's an emerging trend of iced cortados happening as well. Are you familiar with this?
No. What is in a cortado?
A cortado?
A quarter of as much milk or four shots?
It's more on in the milk world. It's like, yeah, it's two shots and then a small amount of milk that's poured in, but it's also not heated to a super hot temperature. So it's meant to sort of just enough milk to get it across the line at a temperature where you can begin sipping it immediately. You don't have to like blow on it for 5 minutes because it's super hot. But it's typically served. When they first emerged, it was like an espresso shot. You would never take it to go. You would, you know, they give it to you, you drink it there, you give them a glass back and you walk out. Now people take it to go, myself included, and now people are icing it. So it's sort of like a skinny girl iced latte in so many ways where it's just, you know, not a full thing of seed oil, oat milk, just a little bit. And then, you know, a bunch of ice cubes that'll eventually melt.
That's fascinating. I didn't drink coffee until I was 28.
Jeez.
And yeah, I think part of it was that I didn't have the patience for hot coffee. And then I discovered iced coffee. So I got into coffee via iced coffee, which is like, you know, now I have some perspective on how cold brew ranks among caffeinated beverages, you know. Mm. It doesn't get more caffeinated than cold brew.
That gets you fucking jacked up, bro.
Yes. And I will never go back there because the reason I had to get caffeine sober is because I was at a point where I was having one cold brew and one Celsius a day.
Mm.
And it caused an amount of anxiety that was not pleasant. So I just fully got off the train. And I had 10 days.
And the anxiety, it made a big difference in your anxiety, quitting the caffeine, you're saying?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I was just having too much caffeine. And also, Celsius isn't just caffeine. Celsius has more than just caffeine in it. It has other things that I think have like a synergistic effect with caffeine.
Yeah, little boosters to help you along the way.
Yes.
Just little kind of cancer-causing boosters in there. It's so yummy.
I mean, they might reduce cancer and just, but they also, they increase anxiety for sure. And yeah, I had gone overboard with caffeine intake, maybe because I discovered it later in life, you know?
Yeah.
But I can't drink hot coffee because I'm too impatient and I don't want to burn my tongue every day. So...
Some people like the sting. What was the last thing? Or actually, you haven't told us what you've eaten today or what you've put in your body.
Okay, I'm going to tell you more about what I ate. Okay.
Two espresso shots.
Yeah, iced Americano. Then I was at the gym. I worked out at the gym. And I followed that up with a smoothie from Earth Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it with double whey protein. I get the one that's like strawberry and pineapple. Coconut water, double whey protein.
Wow.
So
okay.
At that point, oh, and I also had the whites of two hard-boiled eggs. I'm just trying to hit my protein maximums over here. It's not easy.
Okay, so...
Sorry, I should say my protein minimums. I'm trying to maximize my protein intake.
What is the protein grams that you're trying to hit every day right now?
Funny you should mention that. I was talking about that with my trainer today, and he was like anywhere between 100 and 150, which is pretty insane. Like we calculated how many egg whites you'd have to eat to hit that. There's like about 12 grams, I think, of protein in an egg.
I don't think so. I think it's less, but it does take a lot of eggs to get there.
Really?
Yeah. I think an entire egg and one whole egg, yolk included, is 6 grams of protein. So if you take out that yolk.
Okay, so that's right. So it's 12 grams per two, because they sell a packet of two eggs at the gym. So
this motherfucker's buying eggs at the gym. Okay, but you only eat the white part?
Well, yes, because I'm also trying to keep my cholesterol in check. It's like a more recent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I hate to tell you, but some of that protein's living in that yolk, honey.
Yeah. Okay.
That yolk. Okay. So you are eating a Los Angeles diet. It makes me feel comfortable. You fit right in with me at my home as well.
Well, actually, last time we talked on a recorded format, we talked about I think you said you don't eat lunch and you just try to make it to dinner because you like going out to dinner.
I just
is that still your diet, or have you slipped?
Yeah, I would say that I eat, like, during COVID, like deep unemployment COVID, I was only eating dinner. No breakfast, no lunch, no snacks. It was hard line. But then when I ate dinner, I was basically edging dinner. My source of pleasure in life is eating food often. And, you know, it was nice to sort of build up the food tension, the tension between my kitchen and I. And then when, you know, 6 o'clock rolls around, have this amazing feast that you've been working on. And you really eat as if you don't care how many calories are in it or anything like that, because you're eating a day's worth of food in one meal. So you really get to just go all in. But I don't do that quite as much anymore. I'll snack a little bit, but I rarely ever go out to lunch. I'll just, like, nibble on something at the house if I get hungry, and then edge for my big din-din.
And how often do you eat out versus cook?
I would say lately it's been, I'll probably go out to eat twice a week, and then most of it is at home. Because when we go out to eat, it's like, I was thinking about this earlier today, I only really want to eat food that I cannot make at home, or it's way too difficult to make at home. Otherwise, if I can make it at home as good or better, and I know exactly what's going into it, and I can control, you know, how spicy it is or how salty it is or whatever, I'm just going to do it at home, because I will like it more. It may not be better, quote unquote, but I will enjoy it more.
No, sure. That's interesting, because what you remove when you speak about food and eating out versus staying in those terms is you remove the component of, like, going to a restaurant and that restaurant experience, which is,
I think it's a sacred place.
Well, for some people, I think it's, like, a big part of the appeal of going out to eat, the kind of the ritual of it. Mm-hmm. And I think I wasn't very conscious of that until my brother said something about it. Maybe this was like 10, 15 years ago. And it changed the way I thought about going out to eat, like, just the whole experience of it. It's more than just about the food.
So it seems like we're sort of on the subject of healthy, clean eating. Trainers, nutritionists, being conscious about that. Not so much you, but also for me.
But, you know, I used to eat whatever the fuck I wanted for a long time. And, you know, I think different people have different tastes, but, like, I really like those bad for me foods. So, mm-hmm. Like you, like, trying to save it till the last meal of the day. I do enjoy occasionally being able to eat something naughty, like steak frites, which is one of my favorite foods. So, yeah, I'm going to try to eat healthy stuff until we get to the steak free hour.
Okay, so your bad boy junk food once a month naughty girl meal is steak frites. Is a lean fillet of beef and some French fries, not healthy, but it could be a lot worse. There's a lot of people who are, you know, Taco Bell and, you know, shit like that. I think you're doing just fine. Is there a situation where you have, like, a quarterly, like, true bad boy meal? Like, I'm going to fucking Popeye's, Bojangles type shit?
I'm trying to think. I mean...
Or it could be a home thing, like boxed macaroni and cheese or something like that.
Well, you know, when I make rice, I always make it with tadig. So the tadig is usually not going to get finished, and there's going to be some leftover tadig. And you know what? That's pretty naughty, you know, to be getting back into the tadig on day two. Mm-hmm. And just,
but how,
like,
do you not
sneaking in some tadig? We should talk about what tadig is. So, Jason, you dated an Iranian American woman for many years, right? So you learned a lot about Persian culture. Mm-hmm. You and I have eaten together at some Persian restaurants, and I've been impressed. I have to say, I've been very impressed by your knowledge and your pronunciations. And
thank you.
Yeah, and I think you did a good job of ordering for Chris mm-hmm. within the, you know, within the confines of no meat, right? He's still no meat, or does he do fish?
He does a little fish. He's a pesky pescatarian, I'll say, where he will eat fish, but he's very particular about it. He likes just a clean, you know, piece of plain fish with some lemon and olive oil and salt kind of thing. He doesn't like it swimming in a sauce or a béarnaise or, you know, something adventurous like that. But, you know, Persian food, you can really do that. And you can have an amazing flavorful rice with herbs and beans in it. And then just, a grilled piece of salmon with some lemon and dill. And, you know, that's about as good as it gets.
Yeah. Yeah. The way that I like to season salmon is definitely adapted from my mom's recipes. It's like kind of a simplification, but I only use four ingredients: salt, pepper, sumac, and turmeric.
Okay.
Those are my four ingredients. And actually that seasoning also works really well with lamb.
Yeah. Also, to be clear, your mom is not just any old mom who's cooking. Your mom is an authority in the Persian kitchen, if you want to say something briefly about her.
So my mom, her name is Najmiya Batmanguluj, and she wrote a cookbook in America, or actually she wrote her first book in France in 82, and then in 84 she came out with her first book in English. I was born in 83 in America. I'm the only person in my family who was born in America, and that book was called Food of Life, and then she updated it and it became called New Food of Life. And the book is still in print to this day. My mom has been revising it for almost 30 years now, and and it is kind of a mainstay in a lot of Iranian American households. And if you're interested in Persian food, it's a wonderful place to start. And it goes a little further than just food. It gets into cultural culture traditions like wedding ceremony, Persian New Year, which is a Zoroastrian tradition. And I recommend everyone check it out.
Beautiful. Yeah, so it sounds similar to like a Joy of Cooking, Julia Child of the Persian Kitchen in a little bit. A little Martha Stewart, a little Ina Garten.
Yes. My mom has been on Martha Stewart, and I urge everyone to find the clip because I feel like it's the only time Martha Stewart has met somebody with as much agency as her.
Ooh. It's an agency off. I would love to see that.
Yes, because my mom wants to get through the recipe in good, you know, in a timely fashion. And she just, you know, she just keeps going, like, just keeps the, she keeps the pace high in the kitchen. And this is with Martha Stewart. And I think Martha Stewart has never really experienced somebody with that level of energy. And
Martha's
that,
like, okay.
You know, that tenacity.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So you salt, pepper, sumac, turmeric. Do you have that in a shaker in your spice drawer and you just sprinkle that on everything? Or do you make it in the mortar and pestle to order every morning? Or do you have your four little and you put it on the salmon?
I like to keep it in four different. I have the sumac, I have the turmeric, I have the salt. And recently I've gotten into white pepper. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. My wife is a big white pepper fan.
Okay. Yeah. I think white pepper is pretty cool.
It is. She's Vietnamese. I think it's big in the Vietnamese world.
It's subtle.
It is subtle.
Yeah, it's cool. It's got like a little less edge than black pepper, but it also has the flavor. It's like the flavor without the edge.
Like sumac to a lemon, perhaps.
So yes. Yeah, so a lot of people don't know what sumac is. It grows on trees, and it's a citrusy, like, I guess, I don't know if it's a fruit or a flower, but it's a kind of like a citrusy maroon purple powder.
I'm leaning flower, but I'm not positive. But yeah, it is a good cross between maroon and purple. It has a beautiful color to it.
And you could make lemonade with it.
Really? Just the powder?
Yeah, sumac lemonade is a thing. It's like, I think it's like a Virginia thing actually.
Because
I once went to summer camp in Virginia and we made sumac lemonade.
And there's a big Persian community in Virginia, right? Or Middle Eastern in general?
There is a Persian community in Virginia. And actually, my mom recently opened a restaurant. She's a co-executive chef there. It's in Virginia. It's called June, J-O-O-N.
Cute. Junam. Okay. So tadig, going back to that, when you prepare rice in a big pot, the tadig is the crispy layer of rice at the bottom of the pot. You flip it over. And it's kind of brittle and it's thick with oil. And sometimes people will put potatoes or onion, you know, lots of other things to add other flavor to it. It is something that is, to me, very difficult to correctly do. I've never been able to pull it off. I'm not trying very much, but it's one of my favorite foods.
Okay, well, Jason, we got it. we got to get together and discuss, because I've never gotten it wrong.
Okay. I, for some reason, like I'm just so used to cooking rice in the rice cooker that I really, but like a Japanese small rice cooker, not a larger one that you could use for.
Yeah. So for the, I think the trick is to get a Persian rice cooker and it's specifically designed to make tajik. But once you get on that wavelength and you kind of understand what that rice cooker is doing, you can then, you can do it without the rice cooker, which I've done before, like on, you know, like on a camping type trip.
Okay. So that's like taking the training wheels off and doing it like the grandma's. Yes. I mean, but that's really what I want to learn how to do.
Well, I think you should start with a rice cooker, and they're not that expensive. I think it's like 30 to 50 bucks. And, and my mom actually, I think she talks about, at the end of her book, she talks about which are the best brands to buy. But you could also just go to any Persian food market, since you live in Glendale. There's a lot of places.
Yeah. Okay. So when you make it at home, do you, like, I guess walk me through your process, please.
All right. So let's talk about the different rices. So in Persian food, you often will add saffron to rice, which gives it that yellow color and that flavor. And then with that saffron, people often add yogurt. So that's like one kind of subset. If you want to get into the more complex tajiks, you talked about potatoes. That's a great one. But then there's also a lavash bread tajik, which is, to me, that's like some of the highest level Persian stuff. Yeah, that's like that's getting to the tippy top of the skill level. And that's the kind of thing I would ask my mom maybe to make if I came home to DC. And my favorite rice, however, is what's called kate, which is just like the simple white rice. And that is made with water, salt, olive oil, and basmati rice. So very limited number of ingredients. And once you memorize the proportions, you know, you can kind of do it anywhere. But it's about 3 cups rice, 4 cups water, and then maybe like a quarter cup of olive oil and a teaspoon of salt. That's like a standard place to start. You put that in a Persian rice cooker and you leave it for an hour. And that's, you know, perfect tajik right there.
You leave it. That's it. You just put all those 4 ingredients in. There's no order. Do you put the oil in first and then?
No, actually, you don't.
Or is there any order?
Any order. Pour, and then I like to stir it with a wooden spoon for about a minute.
Okay. And we're washing the rice before?
Yes. It's good to wash the rice. And then I also have an invention of my own, which is sushi rice tajik. And for that, I like to soak the rice for a half an hour to an hour.
Okay.
And that is a necessity with it. If you get the really high end sushi rice, it's nice to soak it. But with basmati, I think you could just wash it and it's good to go.
Okay. What about the lid of the pot? People will put towels around the lid, so when the steam rises, the towel catches it, so it doesn't go back down. What's up with that?
So that's something you do if you can't use a rice cooker. Rice cooker has that built in, that allowing a little bit of steam to exit. But yeah, you can definitely use a kitchen towel or cloth.
Okay, so this machine, you dump these 4 ingredients in, you hit start, an hour later you come back, and then do you flip the whole thing upside down?
Yes, you want to flip it.
Okay. And when you flip it, it can sense your confidence and your weakness when you're flipping it, correct?
Yeah. I mean, you just need to have some good gloves and you're good to go.
Okay. You need a big platter.
But yeah, you could burn yourself if you don't know what you're doing.
Okay. And then you flip it over, and then a big pile of rice is sitting there, and then on top, if you've done it correctly, which to you, you've never fucked up.
I somehow never fucked up.
Is you have a perfect sheet of... Okay. And then from there, how do you like to eat the tajik? Do you put some stews on it? The labneh, masmousir, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay. So now we're talking about condiments. yogurt is a big thing in Persian food. So you can eat just plain yogurt. You can use labneh, which is a thicker yogurt. You can mix the yogurt with shallots, which is masmousir. And specifically, I think it's Persian shallots, which is a specific kind of shallot. And then you can also add in cucumbers to the yogurt, ice, raisins, walnuts.
Did you say ice?
Yes, ice is that's, you know, I have a lot of memories of that. The ice just kind of keeps it cool.
I got to write this down. I've never heard of iced mousseur. Mast ice? How do you say ice?
Well, mast khiar, you would add the ice with. So mast khiar, khiar means cucumber. So yeah, the ice is basically to keep it cold. But that's like a thing in Persian food. Like, you want that combination of the cold yogurt and the hot rice with, you know, the hot khoresht. So khoresht is a word for stew. And there's a lot of famous ones. Khoresht sabzi, which is a stew made of greens, like a lot of very herb forward. And there's another one called khoresht ghemeh, which is like a lentil. And so, so let's talk about this. So when you eat food in Persian culture, when you eat food, it's family style. And there's a big pot of rice. You cut the rice usually into like sort of little pie pieces and
pizza slices.
Basically, yeah. And then so that'll be a portion on a plate. And then you'll put something saucy. Let's say it's a khoresht on top of that. Or, you know, anything that's juicy, it could be salmon, it could be lamb, anything where kind of like those juices are dripping over the tadig, because it's that combination that people are looking for. And then you'll have some greens, some fresh mint, some fresh basil, some radishes, and then you'll have a yogurt. Maybe it's mast mousseur or mast khiar, which has the ice cubes and, it can have rose petals, raisins, walnuts. You can get very creative with what you put in there.
Yeah, there's that that white mustache yogurt company that makes the walnut yogurt. Have you had that?
No, I haven't.
I think it's called White Mustache. They're a Brooklyn based.
So how are the walnuts in the yogurt?
Yeah, it's called White Mustache, and it's from a Persian family, but it's literally just a little jar of yogurt, like a little artisan jar of yogurt you can get it at Italy and some other places. And they have one with like orange blossom and honey and fruit, but one of them is just walnuts, and the walnuts are like not really roasted. They're like a little raw and a little roasted, but the flavor of the walnut like gets soaked into the yogurt in a way that is really quite special. But the ice cubes reminded me, we did a podcast a few months ago with Molly Boz, a popular chef, and she was talking about how she puts ice cubes in her cereal every day. She eats a lot of cereal. It's a big part of her life. And she puts ice cubes and a pinch of salt on top of her bowl of cereal because she wants to keep the milk cold and believes that cereal needs a little seasoning. And the thought of adding ice cubes to cereal feels a little insane to me. But then the ice in the yogurt with the cucumber, less insane. But you're still adding ice to dairy. It's still fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, adding ice to dairy is not weird in Persian culture because there's also something called dur, which is like a Persian soda.
I guess there's also ice cream,
which will have ice too. But you know, as you're talking, it makes me think, like, what is the thought process behind adding ice to yogurt and cucumber? And I think it has to do with the cucumbers, because the cucumbers are going to retain their crunch with the ice. Otherwise, you know, if you let those cucumbers get room temp, they're going to get soggy. So
the crunch. Okay. You mentioned that out of all the rices, so I'll go to a Persian restaurant and they'll have a rice with sour cherries in it. They'll have a rice with dill and lima beans, you know, there's lots of berries and raisins and things you can put in it. You said your favorite is the plain white rice.
Yes.
Why is that? What do you love about it?
I think maybe it's like a comfort food thing for me, but also just, I like the way the tadig tastes. I like that the tadig is savory, and you can just really appreciate the crunchiness of the tadig. The flavor profile is a little bit like popcorn in a good tadig. And I think that really comes through with white rice, and you start to lose it when you're adding other ingredients in the mix.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast. We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of TalkHouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than a million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. DistroLock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel, too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
Hey, TalkHouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the TalkHouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrel Flower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
Whenever I would see like big group of a family eating eating a meal at a Persian restaurant, they'll have the dad or the uncle or the grandpa will have, you know, the big plate with his kebab on it and a big mountain of white rice on there, and then some of the rice on top has the yellow saffron. And then he'll take a pat of butter and then kind of hide it inside the center of his mountain of rice while no one's looking, and it kind of has a little secret naughtiness to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. So this is another. So now we're past Tadig 101, Persian food 101, and we passed Mastan Musir, we passed Masakhiar, we're getting, you know, we took a pit stop in adding ice to dairy, and now we're getting into the higher level. So here are some of the higher level things. We have a raw egg yolk on top of the rice. That is a thing that people do.
I have not seen that. I have not. Okay, so yes. Not unlike Japanese or Korean cultures.
Yes, you got a raw egg yolk. But what's interesting about that raw egg yolk is that's happening on a plate. It's not like a dish. It's literally a personalized plate with a raw egg yolk on it. And and then there's also the butter factor. I think that rice should be cooked without butter. I think olive oil, I just like the flavor more. Mm-hmm. I do see the appeal in butter. I see the appeal, but it's not, I don't know. It's, to me, it's not necessarily better.
Okay.
There's a way in which it can take over.
It's a matter of taste.
There's a place called a mini kebab, which is, I believe it's Armenian.
It is.
And so with Armenian food, it's like there's so much connection with Persian food. They're so interwoven. I will say what I think makes, when I taste mini kebab, it feels like it's so closely related to Persian food. But the difference for me is the amount of butter. There's so much butter in every element of the food. And actually, I like it. I think it's really good. To me, that's what sets it apart. To me, that amount of butter isn't exactly part of the Persian flavor profile.
Okay.
To me, it's more about olive oil. But that, you know, that's my own biases.
Yeah, more than one way to skin a cut.
As we get deeper into these higher level thing, there's another thing called torshi. Have you ever had that?
I don't know. Torshi, T-O-R-S-H-I?
Uh-huh.
Sounds like a restaurant I can't get a reservation at. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so torshi is like something that it's kind of like a collection of very, like, extremely pickled vegetables. And it can get, you know, there's different versions of it. You can have like carrots, you can have celery, you can have cauliflower, a lot of dill usually also, but it's basic. It's almost like a vinegary salsa.
Yeah.
And it's something that would be kind of like you put a little bit on the edge of your plate. That's how it would be served in Persian culture, you know? So just like, yeah, the way that Persian food works in a traditional family setting is it's about creating a plate. So like we talked about, we got the rice with tadig, you've got a horesht, you've got a piece of meat maybe, and you've got a corner of the plate that has like some cold yogurt. And then you've got a little corner of the plate that has torshi. And it's about that kind of combination of stuff and fresh greens, like I mentioned, mint and basil. It's like about that combination. Mm. So the reason I mention it is because what is really hard to translate about the Persian eating experience is it's hard to translate that plate style cooking to restaurants, because at a restaurant, it's about like serving people like, you know, a plate of food where they know exactly what everything on the plate is. You know, that's, we've gotten pretty accustomed to that. And it's hard to sort of like apply that style of eating to restaurant culture. So there's all these weird things. Like, so at a Persian restaurant, you'll see tadig is an appetizer, but that is actually crazy because no Persian family eats tadig as an appetizer. Tadig is like, it's the centerpiece of your plate, you know? And they're kind of trying to recreate that by serving you tadig as an appetizer with horesht on top of the tadig. And there's a couple restaurants in the LA area that will do that for you. Like Daria is one, Rafi's that you and I have been together. But it is kind of, it's weird, you know, it's weird to get that as an app because it's not really how Persians eat. They don't eat it as an appetizer, but there's nowhere else to really put it on a menu.
Right. Yeah. They had to change the format. So like whenever you ask a Persian person, what's your favorite restaurant? Or I mean, almost anyone, you know, if you have to go to a restaurant, I would go here, but it's not even close to as good as it is at home. Even if your mom is not that good of a cook.
Yeah. And I actually think, you know, there's very few Persian moms who aren't good cooks.
That's true.
They usually are. And, I think it's a very French thing that we have sort of applied to our lives, which is the idea that the best food you will ever eat is at a restaurant. Like, I think that's something we all take for granted, but it's actually, you know, it's sort of rooted in like the French tradition, which is cool. And like, I like a lot of things about French culture, but it's also sort of rooted in capitalism. This idea that like going somewhere and paying for a service, that's like where you're going to get the peak experience. Mm. And for, you know, for a lot of French food, I think that is true probably, but for Persian food, that's not true.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, lastly, I wanted to talk about maybe my favorite bite of Persian food and sort of saying, which is "nune zire kabab." I think we may have talked about it before, but it translates to like the bread underneath the meat, sort of the lavash bread that you lay down on the plate. You put the kebabs on top, whatever it may be, and then the meat juices soak into the bread. And then you kind of secretly like eating the meat flavored bread more than the meat itself in a sort of a naughty way. And it also has a dual meaning of, you know, maybe kind of liking your partner's sibling more than your partner in a naughty way kind of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wasn't aware of this, the idea of like, you know, the wife's younger sister being that's maybe something you're bringing to the table, which I don't mind. But
let me specify. I think what I heard was it was sort of specifically maybe a cousin or a sibling of your partner who is not considered to be the most attractive partner or member of the family, maybe, you know, like sort of the one that nobody really likes, you kind of secretly like them and you can't say anything kind of thing, or just how you always are, you know, coveting thy neighbor perhaps. But I thought it was an interesting double meaning, but more so I just love the taste of the food.
No, yeah, you're definitely, you got the expression right. The nuances of the expression, I actually, I'm going to talk to my parents about it and we can talk about it together later. I will say using the bread to remove the kebab from the skewer is kind of where that comes from. So you've got a hot skewer with a hot kebab. It's over the coals and then you take it off the coals. You use the bread kind of like just to wrap around it and then you remove it. Mm-hmm. And then you keep that bread around surrounding the meat and it keeps the meat warm. And also those juices, like we talked about, those juices are dripping down and it's creating like beautiful texture and flavors. So.
Yeah. I love that bread glove sliding on out. Okay. Well, I think we're only going to go for 45, but I think we went a little over. I had a blast.
Okay, cool. Yeah, this was fun. Thank you to everyone who's joining us.
Yeah, it was our pleasure. Do you have anything to plug? I guess if you want, you can. I have a food Substack, or I have a Substack that's only a few weeks old, sort of loosely about food, but you can just search Jason Stewart Substack. And my podcast is called How Long Gone.
I'm going to keep it in the tradition of How Long Gone and be a no promo dog right now. All right, guys. Nice to see everyone. Thank you for listening. Nice to see you, Jason.
Hold off.
Thank you to the Talk House. Peace.
Thanks for listening to the Talk House podcast. And thanks to Jason Stewart and Rostam for chatting. If you liked what you heard, please follow Talk House on your favorite podcasting platform and check out all the goodness at talkhouse.com. This episode was put together by Annie Fell and edited by Myron Kaplan, and the Talk House theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.